your host, and this is Authors on the Air. We're proud to be part of the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Tonight, I am speaking to, I know I'm going to do this wrong, and I already asked James, tell me how to say it, James. I said it wrong. I ask you, how do you pronounce your last name?
It's Latwell.
Latwell. I loved looking at the name, and I always think I'm going to say somebody's French name the right way. But, you know, I'm a Polish girl. What do you want from my life? It doesn't work. So James Latwell is with me tonight. He has a very interesting way of writing stories and what his inspiration is. Stay with me. James and I are going to talk without him cracking up laughing at what a bumbling idiot I am. We'll be right back. For being with me, everyone. I'm glad you're here on this Friday night. James Latwell writes stories based on, or they're influenced by, men doing life behind bars. He has a very interesting backstory, but let me tell you a little bit more about him. His work has been recognized by Creative World Awards, acclaimed film, and the Scriptapalooza television script competition. His specialty is crime fiction, and it's very complex, very edgy stories. And I really, really like his books a lot. And he has a lot of experience writing this because he was involved in the corrections department. I'm very happy to welcome James Latwell to the show. James, thank you for being with me, and I'm sorry for screwing up your name. You know, I'm just a bonehead. What can I tell you?
No, you had it right on there. And thanks for having me, Pam.
I'm so glad that you're here. You know, I love your backstory of you. I love the story of your integrating what was once your profession into now your creative side. Have you always been a writer, James?
Not really. I mean, I went into the corrections profession out of college, and actually it was one of the jobs that I had to pay for college as I went through, was working, you know, nights in juvenile hall and that kind of thing. But then I went to probation and then corrections, and I always read a lot. I enjoyed crime fiction and still do, but it wasn't until I left the career in corrections, retired from the prison system, that I really had the time to kind of devote to it and really learn the craft of writing.
Interesting. Did you know right away that your careers would cross, that you would be writing stories about the things you saw with your profession?
There was a time when I would write pre-sentence reports while I was a probation officer, and you'd go up to the jail and interview the defendant and get their version of the story. And it kind of started thinking about, and I started collecting little post-it notes of stories that nobody would believe because they're just too bizarre to be true. Like a guy who got stuck in a chimney that he was trying to, you know, go down and burglarize a house, and he got stuck in the chimney, and that, just bizarre stories that happen out there that nobody would believe.
What was his excuse for that, by the way? What was his excuse for getting stuck in the chimney?
His excuse was he was a meth head, but he just was so high that he just couldn't figure out that this little tiny 8-inch chimney pipe was too small, but he found out that the flue caught him.
So funny.
Yeah.
That's so funny. You know, Christmas playing Santa Claus in the summer, right?
Pretty much. Yeah.
That's interesting. That's funny. So you have all these little post-it notes and little notes of inmate stories that you've collected. And so when you decide to write a story, you've kind of got it sitting right there in your pocket, don't you?
I've got some of the character details, I think. But the stories themselves, I think, kind of flesh out in different ways. At What Cost, the newest release from Crooked Lane, that one kind of came together in two different points, I guess. One was the story kind of deals with a detective, and he's chasing a serial killer who harvests the victim's organs. I mean, that's pretty evident right up front. But what I saw in prison, I was working in a maximum security prison at the time, and we had a lot of violence going on. And we shot and killed an Aryan Brotherhood member on the yard because he was stabbing other inmates, and that's frowned upon. But he died, and we soon learned that his family was donating his organs to for transplant. And having worked with the uh-huh. guy, he was so vile and disgusting and creepy and just filthy that we were thinking, God, who would want those nasty organs?
Right.
And then almost on the heels of that, we had a guy that we worked with whose son needed a bone marrow transplant, and we all went and got on the registry and donated and that kind of thing. And then it kind of hit me that, okay, if I was in that position and I was desperate enough to need, an organ, do I really care where it comes from? And that was kind of how the catalyst of that What Cost came together for me.
It's interesting. Yeah, I can almost see the conflict there. It's pretty interesting, actually. So, but you wrote another book too prior to this one. You wrote a book called Little River. So can we talk about that one first?
Sure.
Would you tell the story about Little River, please?
Sure. Little River was a book that wasn't widely released. It was largely a fundraising apparatus for anti-human trafficking efforts. We donated all of our proceeds to notforsale.org to fund human trafficking recovery efforts and that kind of thing. But the story itself was... kind of a parent's nightmare. You send your kids off to a spring break in Jamaica, and while they're there, they get caught up in a human trafficking web, and the parents have to go down and try to rescue them from this government that doesn't want to acknowledge that human trafficking is going on because it would kind of hamper the tourist efforts in the area and that kind of thing. So it's kind of that story about how they have to manage through that and how far would they go to rescue their child?
That's an interesting thing that we're discussing this tonight, because I was having a conversation with a gentleman in the complex where I live, and he was saying that he had been in Central Florida, and that because I live in Florida, I live on the southwest coast of Florida, and he was saying he had been up in Central Florida and saw signs telling people how to report human trafficking. And he said, it's amazing. They're popping up all over Central Florida through the corridor. And he didn't understand why. And I said, well, this has been a problem for a long, long time. When you're a border country or border state, and we are, even though we're surrounded by water, we still have a lot of people from the Caribbean coming into the state. So it is definitely a problem that has to be addressed. And we even did a global conversation on the sex trade like that, human trafficking and human sexual abuse. It's a nasty thing.
It is. It's huge. And in California, even in Northern California where I'm at, we're a major crossroads for human trafficking, and we've got major freeways coming from San Francisco off through California into Nevada, and there's a lot of traffic that comes through the Sacramento area.
That's amazing. You have a large Asian community, though, don't you?
We do. it's not, I don't think that you could say that it's driven by one particular segment of the population. I think we see a lot of Hispanic populations coming up from the southern border.
Oh yeah, I guess you would.
Getting caught up in promises that were made to the coyotes that brought them over, and they get unwittingly, put into some pretty bad situations.
Yeah. Yep. I guess that's true. And then there's the smuggling in through cargo ships and everything else, some of those big containers that they use on, the gantry cranes have to lift off the ships and everything. So, yeah, Port of Miami is an entry point, too. Yeah. Let's talk about your writing. I want to talk about you as a writer and how you prepare yourself to start a book. Is there something that you do to get ready to write, James? Or are you just one of those people that kind of jumps into it, or are you thinking about a book for a long time? How does it work with you?
I think the idea of whatever this new book is going to be about will be with me for a while. And what I see is, as I'm finishing up a book and I know that I'm coming to the close of this particular project, I almost get an itch about, okay, I've got to move on to something new. I've got to do something different. And it kind of spurs me to hurry up and finish what I've got and jump into something new. But I kind of have to know what exactly it is I'm doing. So I'll do a lot of research or travel. I've been looking at a book based out of, we're talking about the southern border, mm-hmm. out of Arizona. So I've been spending a lot of time in Arizona. I get to see my son who lives down there, so that's a big positive.
Nice.
So you look at the culture and the laws and the immigration focus of places like Phoenix and Tucson, and it starts to kind of lay out this whole culture of a story is there. So, go ahead.
Am I to assume that you start off with the idea for the story before you have a character, or do you have a character already that you're going to plant into a story?
I've done it both ways. Like with the At What Cost and the Detective Penley series, Penley is a and his partner Paula Newberry are major characters, so they'll
right.
transplant story to story. But two that I'm working on now, I came up with the idea first of what the overreaching story arc would be, and then who best fit that kind of came second. So I've done it both ways.
Is your focus on character or on the narrative, on the storytelling aspect of it?
I like character. I like character-driven kind of stories. The personalities really come about, and the characters to me make it fun, and they're actually fun to write that way. You can mm-hmm. really see their personalities start to develop and their backstories, especially when you go from book to book in a series like we're doing with At What Cost and mm-hmm. the Henley series. You can really see the dynamics of the main players, how they develop over time and bring out some of their quirks and habits.
Are you surprised when a secondary or even a tertiary character steps forward?
I am. Because I'm not a complete plotter. I don't have to have an outline that, drives me from, morning to
mm-hmm.
night. I know
mm-hmm.
I know where I'm going to start and I know where I'm going to end, before I start actually writing. But how I get there, I kind of let the characters kind of run with it.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they run me into corners, but, that's cool because I could get them back on track. But, yeah, there's been some secondary characters that have kind of come up out of the woodwork, and that's actually how John's partner, Paula, started. She wasn't
mm-hmm.
much of a character in my initial drafts of the manuscript, and because I felt she really had something to add there, and just their opposing personalities and dynamics and trust issues and that kind of thing, I think it added a whole lot to the story as it went forward.
Tell me about writing from different POV. One of the things that I noticed and authors do really well or not well at all is differentiate the voice of their characters, whether it's male and female, two men, two women, whatever it happens to be. I don't want characters that speak the same way. Do you understand? Does that make sense
right.
to you? Do you know what I'm trying to say? Like, I don't want them to use the same colloquialisms. I don't want them to curse the same way. I don't want them to use the same grammar because obviously we all speak differently. Is it difficult writing point of view like that, especially female and male characters?
It's I know exactly what you mean, Pam, because
yeah.
you know, if you get into that plain vanilla kind of dialogue and
yes.
it's hard to know who's talking. But yeah, I know what you mean, and it's not difficult. I think I have a lot of readers that are women. My
mm-hmm.
wife is one of them, and she'll say, "Hey, you know, no mother is ever going to say this, or no
right.
woman is ever going to, you know, admit this, you know." And she'll circle that on the manuscript and say, "You know,
uh-huh.
better luck next time. Try again."
Right.
My editor. But my local editor is a woman. My agent's a woman, so I get honest feedback that, you know, don't mansplain this. You know, just get
right.
on with the story.
Right,
but,
right. mansplain
yeah.
it.
But also, yeah. But also, when writing women law enforcement characters, I was lucky enough to work with a lot of women through the
sure.
29 years in the Department of Corrections, and there's a whole set of issues and barriers and struggles that they had to put up with that,
yep.
You know, I didn't as a guy going through the same system. And
sure.
I saw that struggle and it's real and it leaves a mark. So you kind of have to reflect that in the story.
In the story. That makes sense to me. Do you have a preference for writing for either a man or a woman in your stories? Does it matter? Do you like writing dialogue?
I do. I like writing dialogue. To me, that really brings up the breadth and life of the character itself. You get that colloquialism. You get the feeling for real emotion and that kind of thing that comes across in dialogue that might get lost in narrative
right.
stuff. From place to place. So I enjoy that. Yeah.
It propels the story pretty much from point A to point B in a rapid way if you need it to. It's an economy of
mm-hmm.
words when you are storytelling, isn't it?
I think so. You can lay out a pretty detailed scene in a couple of lines of dialogue that, you know, you don't need page after page of descriptions of the weather and the trees
right.
and how hard the wind is blowing
right.
to get across
right, right.
what you need to have. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. Do you ever read your dialogue out loud?
I do. I do. I have to admit that, yeah, I've been caught talking to myself, yeah.
But you know, that's a good thing. And I've been told, and it's been my experience, because I like reading dialogue. I like reading narrative too. But I mean, I like reading everything. What am I talking about? I mean, you know, I read the side of a cereal box if I have to. But isn't that crazy? But I think that when you read out loud, at least in my opinion and what I have found, if I'm reading something exceptional, it's firing a different synapse in my brain when I'm hearing it, when I'm speaking it and then hearing the words versus just having that visual in my mind and reading quietly. So I often wonder, you know, if authors do the same thing, if while you're writing, you ever go over your dialogue to see how it sounds when you're speaking it. It would seem to me to be something important to do, particularly if you're going to do an audiobook.
Particularly an audiobook, but I do. What I've seen is you pick up some inflection or maybe a word that isn't emphasized on the page, that you can kind of hear it when you talk. So you've got to kind of tweak that dialogue to make it get the emotion and properties across that you're trying to convey.
Exactly. I think it's a wise person who does that. You know, a wise person who who reads their, the writer who reads their dialogue out loud. I want to take a second here to remind everyone that I'm talking to James Littwell. Say it again.
Very good.
Littwell. I'm getting there. I should write it down in front of me, except I'm blind as a bat anyway. I won't see it. But I want to invite callers in. I'm going to give away a Kindle copy of James's current book to whoever calls in first. The number is 347-633-9609. Feel free to chime in with comments, questions, likes, dislikes, anything you want. 347-633-9609. James, what do you do in your spare time when you're not writing? Because writing is a fairly singular, difficult pursuit, and even on the best days when you're in the zone. So you kind of got to step away from it for a little while and clear your head, and you know. So what do you do so that you're not bogged down by it all?
Yeah, it gets exhausting. At least it does to me.
I'm sure.
I spend more than 4 hours, 4 hours is about my limit. Where after that, if I don't take a break, at least I'm mush. But I spend a lot of time doing dog training and therapy work with our dogs. My wife and I have a pair of Pembroke Welsh Corgis, and we take those. Yeah, they're great.
How
we take
cute.
Those to memory care units where Alzheimer's and dementia patients are.
Yes.
Assisted living. But we do a lot of reading programs for kids where they just read out loud to the dogs.
I have heard about programs like this, especially when children read to kids children read to animals that are in shelters. They're waiting for adoption.
Yep.
And it improves the child's reading skills as well as being soothing for the animals, right?
Oh, it does. Yeah, our dogs.
I think it's a brilliant idea. What a great way to socialize both the child and the animal, too.
Oh, it is. We do that at local libraries. We do it at a local independent bookstore once a month. It's this Sunday, as a matter of fact, at Facing a Book down in El Dorado Hills. So y'all come. Bring your kids.
There you go.
And, yeah, they just have a blast. And what we found is that kids with kids on the autistic spectrum really react well with the dogs.
I bet they do.
They kind of forget about all the other pressures and stimuli and everything going on. They just focus on the book and they pet the dog, and parents love it. And it's really something to see.
How amazing. How really just amazing. Is your wife a writer also, James? I mean, you're not, obligated to tell me anything about. I just am curious if she was a writer also. She sounds really cool, and please tell her I said so. How wonderful that you do these things. I mean, that's really cool, and that's a great way to kind of clear away the crowdedness in your head too. You're talking about how, you know, the kids on the spectrum have all that noise going on inside, and you kind of calm them. I would imagine what you're doing for them does the same thing to you.
It does. It's very refreshing, and it's just fun to do. One other thing we do with the dogs while we're talking about that is University of California, Davis isn't far away from where we are. And during finals week at the college at the university, a bunch of the therapy animals get together and they do therapy fluffies. So as all the kids are coming out of their finals, all stressed and stuff, they come and visit the dogs and pet them and love on them, and then they feel better. So it's kind of
what a great idea. Animals are wonderful. I mean, I'm no one to ever dismiss the value of pets. I have 5 rescued cats. I would be bereft if I did not have each and every one of them in the bed with me every single night or surrounded every time I do a podcast, I have to tell you. So I understand, I understand the need to have animals around you. It greatly enhances your life. There's no doubt. I much prefer my cats to some people that, that live in the same development. So I totally understand that, you know. I want to talk about hostage negotiation. Tell me about that. Tell me about that. And what
I would say,
what does it take for you personality wise to be an effective hostage negotiator?
Yeah, I was a prison hostage negotiator for a period of time at Folsom Prison.
Wow.
And what that is, there's an entire team of people, and I'm just one person on the team as the primary negotiator. Where you're trying to resolve the situation, you know, whatever it might be, if it's, you know, a cook taken hostage in the kitchen, or, you know, a teacher being held in a vocational classroom, you're working to resolve that situation so nobody gets hurt. So you've got the tactical people on the CERT team, you know, trying to find out, you know, what kind of access there is to the place. And so there's a lot of things going on. And my job is to just keep communication with the hostage taker, try to get them to, you know, start humanizing the hostage.
The victim.
And, you know,
sure.
Keep the lines of communication going. Often it's something as simple as, you know, they need a phone call to mom. You know, they haven't talked to mom, and, you know, that kind of stuff. So if you can get,
it's interesting.
You know, get those kind of little issues resolved, you know, there you go.
It's interesting to me that you have to have a hostage negotiator and that it's effective in a place where these guys aren't coming out most of the time, you know, or a lot of them are there for life, and they kind of have a I got nothing to lose type attitude. So that must make it even touchier for the negotiator.
It's a different environment. And when I was at Folsom, back in the day, it was a maximum security prison before they had started the new prison construction boom. We added, I think, 20-something new prisons in California. And at that time, it was, you know, Folsom and San Quentin were the two, you know, level 4
prisons. It's a hell of a commentary, isn't it? Isn't that a hell of a commentary on our society? It's mind-boggling to me. Yeah. That's another subject, though.
Yeah, no, when I started with the Department of Corrections, I think our statewide prison population was, God, I want to say less than 30,000. And by the time I retired, we were up over 176,000. We just, you know, tried to build our way out of the criminal business. And
if you build it, they will come. I mean, really, if you build it, they will come.
Yeah.
And, you know, for every little thing and every major thing, and that's really sad. Let's go back to writing. You know, so you've taken the break and you're now refreshed. Do you write in a quiet space, or are you one of those people that can write with the cacophony of people talking and, you know, in a coffee shop and cups clinking together and, you know, people shouting orders and all that? It's fascinating to me, people that can do that. I can't think. I mean, I'm lucky to get out the door with my dress not on backwards, you know, so all that noise is not good for me. But I admire anyone who can do it. What's your process like, James?
I have a dedicated space in the loft upstairs. It's a loft where I've got a little writing nook set up with, mm-hmm. you know, my desk, computers, and, you know, that kind of things that I need. I don't have to have it quiet. I'll usually have some music going or my headphones on and music, and, you know, the dogs will be running through the house barking and that kind of stuff. And that noise doesn't bother me. In terms of writing, I have tried writing out in coffee shops, and it's okay, but I kind of like writing in my own space, partially because, like we talked about, if you start saying your dialogue out loud in a coffee shop, you know, you get some weird looks.
Right.
So,
well, then they'll just say, oh, it must be a writer, you know? That must be a writer.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Yeah.
That's so funny. Do you do a... you mentioned 4 hours, and that seems to be it. Are you hopeful to reach a certain number of words before you call it a day, or is it strictly by the hours that you're there working, whether it's research or the actual writing or plotting or whatever it is you're doing? How do you structure your day?
I'm not firm to the end limit, but usually I'll, you know, get up, have coffee, breakfast, you know, that kind of thing, and then I'll come up to my office. And it usually ends up being about a four-hour block. Now, if I'm in the middle of a chapter or a scene and I really want to, you know, nail it down, I'll extend that a little further.
Sure.
I'm not a word counter. I don't look at, you know, how many words do I have to have today, you know, that kind of thing. It's just, it's kind of like by feel, you know. I've ended this scene, and or I'll quit in the middle of a scene, knowing that that'll help me pick up when I come back the next time, because it's in the middle of this climatic, you know, situation that we've got to resolve, and that'll help me just jump right back into it when I start again.
Yeah, I often wonder these writers who write to a word count, how, if that creates even more stress, because it seems to me telling a story with the dialogue, the narrative, the characters, the world building and everything is stressful enough. Writing, being a writer is stressful enough. And then you have to meet a word count. And then there's a deadline that you have to meet. And then you have to know you're going to go through it. It just seems like, why do you do that? That's torture. I mean, that's torture.
It would be for me. I mean, because
I would be the one. It's self-flagellation. I don't understand it. Yeah.
Yeah, and if I didn't hit my, you know, 2,000 words today, and so I have to carry that over to tomorrow, and no.
Yeah, it's a snowball. It starts real small and ends up being a snowman. It's crazy.
Yeah,
I posted today on Facebook about Owen Laukkanen, who writes 5,000 words a day. I thought, holy crap.
Yeah, I saw that.
That's a lot of words to write in one day. I mean,
yeah,
he's got a book done in a month if you write every day like that. That's crazy.
There's some people I know that Joe Clifford is one of them. He'll knock out a book in a month and a half.
I know.
And
he does.
He'll just lock himself up until he does it. But man,
his writing is pristine. His writing is so good.
Mm-hmm.
Russell Blake
is
another one. You know, the guy cranks out 8 or 9 books a year. So, you know, there's something to be, they're doing something. I don't think I've ever been that disciplined. I'm having a hard time getting through 7 shows this week. So, you know, and my job is a hell of a lot easier than what you guys are doing. Do you read while you're writing? In other words, do you pick up somebody else's book to read? You're not concerned about storyline overflowing
about spillover or anything? About voice or character or spillover?
Yeah.
No. I read all the time. I'm not worried about that.
What do you like to read? Are you strictly a genre guy and the genre you write in? Or do you cross genre?
I do cross genre. I still like crime fiction. That's probably my passion. But I'll read anything. I'll admit it here. I've read YA Paranormal and I liked it. Okay. So
good for
you.
Know,
hurt me now.
I mean, there's some really good YA paranormal out there. Some good YA science fiction out there that's out, especially
there
good.
Is.
Yeah.
Yeah. To me, a good story is a good story. I don't care
how
you get there. Yeah.
Well, you know, I think that it's a shame that we say genre fiction anymore these days. I am not a reader of literary stuff. I'm just not smart enough. I can't read historicals and I can't read literary stuff. I like genre. I really do. But wasn't there a day, James, back in the time probably when you and I were starting reading, that it was just fiction or nonfiction? And
that's right.
You know, then booksellers came along, and I mean, I remember distinctly going into bookstores. That's the fiction section and that's the nonfiction section. And the nonfiction section was the one that was broken up by genre, whether it was self-help or dogs or gardening, something like that. Otherwise, fiction was just all in there together. Yeah. You know, you had romance.
All mixed together.
Yeah. Everything mixed together. So you went alphabetically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But now
we have to
kind of separate it out by genre, and I blame Amazon for just about everything. You know,
I think it's a marketing decision, I think, yeah.
Yeah.
How do you market your segment of the world?
Right. And so, you know, I would imagine you could go in several different places on the bookshelf between crime fiction, thrillers, mysteries, police procedurals, and, you know, things.
Sure.
There's mysteries, and it's unlimited, all the stuff that you can do. It's crazy. Tell me what Scriptapalooza television script competition is.
Oh, yeah. Scriptapalooza has been running a script competition for, at least a decade. And basically, there are different categories, but you can pick a category. Let's say it's television drama, and you write a spec script for an existing show, just like it was coming out of the Hollywood producer's Bible. And you write all the existing characters and kind of take that storyline to where you think it could go. It's kind of a neat little exercise. So. And screenwriting is so different than writing traditional fiction work. Yeah.
Because that's driving the story completely. There's no bells and whistles on that. You're not looking at narrative. I don't care what color blue the sky is. You are really just moving that story forward, right? That's an economy
exactly.
of words if you can write a script. Interesting.
Yeah, it's very stripped down. It's very visual And I think being able to do that visualization of it has actually helped my fiction writing be a little bit more economical in getting across what I want the reader to kind of envision as they're going through the story.
Sure. So if you're writing 80,000 words, you want it to be 80,000 strong words. Who is it? Dutch Leonard says, you know, don't write stuff people aren't going to read. I mean, obviously I'm paraphrasing, but it's interesting to me that I can pick up a book that is just action driven entirely, completely moving forward. And I mean action. There's something happening that's kicking the blocks down. It's like dominoes falling in one of those super chains. You know, you tip one domino over and keep on going. That's how I want a book to read. I don't want any breaks.
Oh, yeah.
I want my break to come at the end of a chapter. And then I take a deep breath and I dive into the next part. And from what I've been told, script writing teaches you how to do that because you can't put in any filler. Yeah.
Right.
Interesting. Interesting. Whose books do you like to read?
Oh, God. Well, you mentioned Leonard. I mean, Elmore Leonard, I loved his stuff. I've always loved his.
Yeah. It's great, isn't it?
And then, in the genre, I think you've got Michael Conley.
I
started off with his stuff very early, and I like the earlier stuff, to be honest, more than his later stuff.
The later Bosch stuff, you mean? You like the standalone versus series?
Like,
they're different.
The series is okay, but one of his books that I really like that doesn't get a lot of hype is The Poet. I mean,
it was
his standalone. It was a
brilliant
book.
Oh, brilliant. When you talk about the top people like Michael Connelly, I'm thinking C.J. Box and Jeffrey Deaver and Robert Crace, almost all of whom have been on the show except for Mike Connelly. And Jeff Deaver's coming back again because his book just released and I've finished reading it and it's really great. But, I like those two. Who else do you like to read?
Oh, God, I like, Robert Crace, I think you mentioned, Greg Hurwitz.
Greg last week.
Yeah, there's just, he's a character. But,
he's a great guy.
And then when you get to read those people and then you, because I'm still a fan of some of these authors, and when you go to a writer's conference and you get to actually see them and talk to them.
Oh, yeah.
It just puts a whole different flavor on the words that you read that they wrote, and now you kind of understand what their process is and how they thought of it. It's just fun. Just fun.
It's
to
a collegial community, that's for sure. Yeah,
would imagine, yeah.
Yeah, your tribe is a very collegial tribe for sure. I have been blessed to go to a lot of writer conferences, and feel very honored to be included in a lot of stuff, I have to tell you, and, you know, have met a lot of writers. You talk about being a little starstruck. I'm the biggest fangirl there is. This is why I do talk radio, because I just love talking to writers. So, you know, that's, I told you, books are air as far as I'm concerned. What I don't hear a lot are some of the women writers who I think have made a big difference in crime fiction. For example, Sarah Paretsky, Sue Grafton, you know, Catherine Coulter, J.D. Robb. I like hearing their names, you know, being mentioned in among the top male writers too, because they are just as good, if not better in some things. So I
Rachel Housel. Yeah, Rachel Housel.
Oh, Rachel Hall. She's amazing.
She's tremendous.
She's been on the show.
And then
she's funny. She's funny as anything. She's brilliant.
She really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then there's another one out of Crooked Lane is Carrie Smith. Carrie's writing a procedural series, and really good stuff. Really good stuff. Love it.
Oh, that's good. I like seeing more women writing crime fiction too. And I don't think they need to take a pen name to do it, or a man's pen name.
Nope.
I think that they need to write under their own names. You know, you were talking about seeing people, women in corrections and the crap they had to go through. And, you know, it's been difficult in the book world too, for a lot of women, I think, who started writing crime fiction. So I'm grateful for those that are, I'm in mourning because Sue Grafton is coming out with Why this year. And I'm thinking, oh no, you know, and then it's one more after that, you know, and I'm bereft. I don't know what to do with myself, thinking that there's not going to be another book. Oh, well, it is what it is. We are almost out of time. I have just so loved talking with you. I could speak for another hour. Well, I can always talk another hour, but I'm not going to take your time. blabbermouth that I am. But let's play Final Five. Five quick questions, five quick answers. You game?
Sure. Let's do it.
Okay. All right. Music that you're listening to nowadays? Genre, band, anything? Oh, okay, good one.
Yeah.
I like them.
Stone Temple Pilots,
Whose book are you reading right now?
Jeff Abbott.
Oh, I just got one.
Final Order.
Yeah. Just got that one. It's not bad, huh? I think that came in my batch today.
No, I like it.
Yeah. I like his stuff. I want to get him on the show. I think I just got that one today. I don't know. I got 10 books today. I have to look. Now it's going to make me crazy. I'm sure it's sitting in the pile right here. So what is something we would be surprised to learn about you? By the way, I have Jeff Abbott's new book called Blame, just to tell you.
Okay.
It's not even out yet. Okay.
So
I'll send it to you when I finish reading it, okay?
Cool. Great.
All right. So what is something we would be surprised to learn about you, James?
Some of my first playmates were prison inmates.
Really?
I grew up on prison grounds when I was a kid. My dad was a career corrections guy, so we moved all over the state, and I lived on prison grounds. So the gardeners and yard tenders were inmates. And at the time, those were inmates doing life back then, because you could have lifers in conservation camps. So I remember a couple of inmates in particular would ride me around the wheelbarrow as I you know, did my kid stuff, and they'd, you know, ride me from place to place in the wheelbarrow while they did their gardening and lawn tending. Another inmate showed me how to take care of pigeons and that kind of stuff. And so that's kind of my
– holy cow. What a really interesting thing. You know, I think most of us have a perception, and maybe deservedly so, of these really hardcore guys, but a lot of them have families. I mean, they were kids themselves at one time. It's like you said, call mama. Sometimes that's all it takes. So, of course, of course they would enjoy being around a kid. I think that would be great.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
I write a lot about the harder side of corrections with, you know, that population. But one of the things that, that I did while working with the Department of Corrections was in substance abuse programs. I set up drug programs in various prisons all over the state. And it kind of put a different spin on prison for me, was that, you know, it did show that under the right circumstances, you know, you get the right guys in the program, and it does make a difference. And
I bet,
you know, redemption is possible for a lot of these guys.
And, you know, it also probably gives you insight into how everything went sideways too, I would imagine.
Oh, very much. Very much.
Yeah. Okay. So, tell me something on your bucket list.
My bucket list. Oh God.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know that I really have a bucket list. I've been kind of fortunate to do what I want to do, especially since I retired, to kind of just live life on our terms. It's kind of fun. I don't have a list of, you know, places I want to go or things I want to do. I've been able to do a lot of those, and I don't
have
any real regrets of things that I've missed. No.
Good for you. I like hearing that. I have about 5 books that every year, no matter what, I go back and read those 5 books. You know, various times I don't read them all in a cluster. But do you have a book like that you will read over and over? Really, what is it?
I have a couple. And one of them is Conley's Poet that we talked about.
Yeah.
Another one is the first Anne Rice book I picked up, which was The Witching Hour. In particular, of her stuff, I really enjoyed that one. It just evoked a real sensation of place and time. And
I thought her books are very visceral, I think, aren't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Especially that one in that series. Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with their television series that she's creating with her son, Christopher. I have never been a fan of the vampire books, but I do like her other work. Well, I don't like her erotica work, but I do like her other stuff. And
yeah,
she's
the
very
vampire
interesting.
Stuff, yeah. Oh,
that,
really?
You know.
Yeah.
It's not my thing. I don't mind vampire stories, but I'm afraid of horror, to be honest with you. So, you know, like old Vincent Price movies used to scare the crap out of me. I'd be hiding under the bed.
Yeah.
So I can't read a lot of realistic horror because I get really bad nightmares. And, you know, so I just, it's not a genre I'm taken with, I have to tell you. So I admit to not being smart enough to read literary or historical, but I'm just a fraidy cat when it comes to horror. So, you know, but I do like her work. It's very good. And I love Christopher's writing too. He's very good.
Yeah.
James Littoil, I have had the best time talking to you. I hope that one day you'll come back and visit me again. And thank you so much for spending. Yeah. Thank you for spending so much time with me. I took more time than I told you I would. I hope you don't mind, but it's been a real joy speaking to you. And learning about your writing life and about you growing up on a prison ground, it's fascinating to me. It really is. You know, have fun with the dogs and all, and thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Pam. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks. Good night.
Good night, Pam. Bye-bye.
And that's our show for tonight, folks. On Monday, Vigilante Happy Hour premieres. You got to be around for this one. Claude Bouchard, Alan Leveroni, and Luc Romain are the hosts. It's 3 countries on 2 continents with Russell Blake as their first guest. So we're bringing in another country. It's going to be crazy. I wish you all a lovely weekend. Read a good book. Thank you, Mom and Dad. And thank you, folks.